field again. I needed to get clear and find a place to replenish. I hoped Coyote was doing the same thing. The Draugr continued to retreat, but those that Hel had raised from the dead fought on. Whatever she had done to them did not require her constant control. At least she wouldn't be raising any more. Not that there weren't still huge problems to solve. The Draugr might have no stomach to fight the armies ready for them, but they weren't popping back through the portal to the gloomy realm of Hel, either. They were going around the lake to the north, toward human settlements, where maybe a handful of people had a few things ready just in case of a zombie apocalypse, but the rest were woefully unprepared. And then there was the issue of what had happened to Loki. A thunderous roar shook the air. Loki had found the body of Hel.
"Where are you going?"
he boomed in Old Norse, and I thought at first he meant me, but it turned out he was talking to the Draugr.
"You must fight and win if you want any peace. Fight!"
I don't know what he was talking about there, what lie or promise he had made them, but it worked. The Draugr spun around and fought much more viciously than before, and the sudden reversal was devastating to the pursuing troops, who had broken ranks. Briat still stood, but the Fey host was much reduced. The remaining Olympians continued to fight well. The Einherjar and the dwarves were engaged, but the Alfar and Svartalfar both took heavy losses on the reversal. I saw no sign of the Yeti, and the Norse pantheon still hid behind a dark cloud of Thor's making, though it had advanced somewhat on the right. I imagined that anything that walked into that cloud would not be walking out. In the meantime, Loki could not target them, and they likewise could not seem to find him. I would have expected Odin's spear or Thor's hammer to have flown by now, but they held back. Loki's voice rolled across the field again.
"Druid, I have your sword. I know it was you."
I cleared the edge of the battle and dropped to the earth a safe distance away, behind the Svartalfar troops. I felt a tiny trickle of the earth's magic there, fading but still available. I shifted to a hound so I'd have some speed and some teeth if I needed them, and then refilled my bear charm and resumed healing. So Loki had found Fragorah. I was ready to let him have it for all the good it would do him. I should go straight to the nearest bound tree and exit. I'd help take out Hel. Got my throat cut, and almost become a doggy treat. That was enough. No reason to stay, except maybe to root for Athena to win me 1,000 boxes of Girl Scout cookies. Off to my left, a Draugr staggered out past the dark elves and transformed in front of me into a coyote. It was, in fact, Coyote himself, who'd crossed the field successfully. He let his tongue hang out as he trotted up to me, and I thought he was going to stop, but he merely bobbed his head and kept on going. I chuffed in laughter. I couldn't blame him, and I took a few steps after him thinking I'd go with him and buy him a few beers somewhere. But Loki's voice called out again.
"Come on, Druid. You've killed all my children. Come and face me now. You know where I am. Come and face me."
I stopped, and so did Coyote. He turned around and sat, waiting to see what I would do. I tilted my head at him, and he mirrored the action. Smartass. Loki was under a misapprehension. I hadn't actually killed any of his children, not really. Granuel and Freya had both played major roles in killing Fenris. I'd only witnessed the death of Jormungandr, and if Loki would simply think clearly for a moment, he would realize that my sword on the ground next to Hel was not, in fact, the spear stuck in her back. I was not the cause of death. I still didn't need to face him. I didn't think I could take him, honestly, not without Fragorah and a whole lot of luck. But I did know where Hel's body was, and I could lead others there. With Loki out of the picture, it would be over. The Norse could handle things from there. Wouldn't it be worth it, then, to do at least that much? I raised a paw to Coyote, and then pointed my body back to the battle, keeping an eye on him. Coyote shook his head and turned tail, trotting away. I was on my own for this one. Fair enough. I'd get myself some armor and a sword from the field and find Briat. She could fight Loki's fire with her own fire. and feeling the land go dead beneath me again, I knew Loki needed to go sooner rather than later. Chapter 21. The eruption is different this time. The previous ones happened while I was on the rooftop with Wukong, but this one I can feel through the soles of my feet, and through the tattoo on my right heel I can feel the paroxysm of pain that the elemental is experiencing, the profound drain that's occurring due to this portal opening and closing repeatedly. The land near here will die, like the land in Arizona around the portal Angus Ogh made. That was high chaparral desert, and this is subtropical forest. Obviously not a worry for the Yama Kings, who'd like to do far worse, but it's the sort of thing that ignites my ire, and I have no qualms about judging the situation. This should not be allowed. I try to communicate with the elemental Taiwan, whose voice already sounds tired. Query, who opens the portal?
Local deities, she says.
Taiwan must mean the Yama Kings. Query, can I stop them?
No. Portal opened from other side.
It would have to be voluntarily closed by the one who opened it, or, as with the others, by the actual defeat of the Yama King in question. It occurs to me that perhaps I should rephrase the question. Query, can I prevent next one from opening?
Yes. Slay deity first.
In other words, if I want to end this, I need to skip this fight, go to the next hell, and kill the Yama King there on his own turf. Wukong, which Yama King is this?
The sixth, King Bian Cheng. The fifth is staying out of this mess.
The demons and the damned begin to land on the slopes, and Wukong's clones engage some of them. More stream in our direction. So who's the seventh?
He is called the King Taishan.
What's he look like?
Why do you ask?
If I take him out ahead of time, can we end this early? Will the other Yama Kings keep coming if they know King Taishan never even made it here?
You mean go to the seventh court and kill him there?
Yes, that. Please don't say it's dangerous. So is being on this mountain right now. Just tell me if killing him will stop the others.
I think it might. Why would the others risk such a preemptive defeat? And I was going to say, that's unexpected. Are you, perhaps, looking at things differently?
No. I think I'm still in the same frame of mind. I just want to protect Gaia. What's King Taishan look like?
He wears a judge's cap, like all the Yama Kings. His robes are blue because of the cold hell he watches over, Utpala, which turns the skin of all the damned blue. But he also rules a fiery hell called Tapana.
All right. Let me see if this is even possible. The damned reached us, and I had to separate headspaces to continue the conversation. But this time I battled in Whitman's English headspace so that I would have the Latin one to speak to the elemental. Query, where is tether to seventh hell of Dayu?
No druidic tether exists. Must be escorted by deity of Pantheon.
Balls. I hadn't tried out my Polish headspace yet because it wasn't technically complete. I still had some poems to absorb and some fluency to achieve in Polish. But perhaps I could use it well enough to fight the damned. These from the sixth court of Bian Cheng had different wounds and marks on them than the ones from the fourth. They had been pierced and sliced with steel, and some of them still had spikes poking out of their flesh. But Skawaja caved their heads in just as easily. No time like the present to see if I could juggle three headspaces. I would need to if I ever wanted to shift planes with more than just Orla. I switched my battle to the Polish headspace and gave it some time and some lines from Szymborska's soliloquy for Cassandra to make sure it was established, a fitting poem since Cassandra kept telling people something terrible was about to happen and was never believed.
Toya, Cassandra, atoyest moye miasto pod popioyam. Ato jes moje laska istonski proratskie. Ato jes moja głowa pełna wątpliwości.
I kept that going in my head while I fought, then flipped on the English for conversation. Wukong, the elemental says I need a deity from your pantheon to escort me to hell and back. There are no druidic tethers to that plane. He did not answer right away, and for a time it was just the sounds of battle, crunches and screams and grunts.
But eventually he said, "There is one who can do this. He will be here soon."
"Who?"
"The immortal warrior, Erlan Shen. Do you know him?"
"I know of him, sure. Wasn't he the one from the stories that subdued you so long ago?"
The Monkey King laughs even as his iron rod destroys the damned and sends them back to Maheroriva, one of the hells over which King Bianchen presides.
"Yes, I remember well. He is the one who defeated me in battle in the days I was rebellious against heaven. But now we are on the same side. His arrival was already planned to come at the emergence of King Bianchen."
And when the warrior does come, some minutes later, he is a riot of colors and a pageant of death. His hound accompanies him, very similar to a wolfhound, in fact, but far more used to battle than Orla is, or will ever be, if I have anything to say about it. Together they cut a swath through the hordes of the damned as they move to join us at the base of Seven Star Mountain. The Monkey King is glorious and impressive, to be sure, but as Erlan Shen descends from the heavens, I think he could practically slay people with how badass he looks. A mixture of flowing red and white silks and hardened leather armor inlaid with gold and accents of jade. Steel armor is not necessary for him, since even without a stitch on, he's practically impervious to weapons. His chosen weapon is sort of like a spear, except the head is three-tipped and double-bladed. Rumor has it that the weapon functions much like Fragora and can cut or punch through armor as if it were cotton. It certainly seems to have no trouble slicing through the damned as if they were cucumbers instead of flesh and bone. And once he lands and introductions are made and the plan is revealed to him, I am brought forcefully to the question once again, why am I here? Because Erlan Shen and the Monkey King can obviously take care of this on their own. Both are more skilled and powerful than I and would easily be able to defeat King Taishen without my help. I'm not even needed for them to shift planes. It's, in fact, they who must shift me to the Seventh Court. So for what purpose have I been sent here by Briat? I worry about her motivation more than these Buddhist deities, because the first among the Fae didn't get that title granted to her. She earned it by being stronger and smarter than everyone else. And it has to be something significant, doesn't it, if she's gotten the Monkey King to agree to her scheme? It can't be simply to help Taipei by battling these poor souls. I mean, I'm sure she'd want me to minimize the damage here as much as possible, but if that were all, there would be no need to have Flittish bring me here with code phrases and magic apples and have Sun Wukong laid down mystic riddles on my brow. She could have simply said to minimize the damage, and I would have done it. It's an uncomfortable feeling, knowing that gods are playing a game with you as a prominent piece, but you're not able to see the board or even know the rules. And then the puzzle turns and clicks into place for me like a Rubik's Cube, or at least a part of it does. I have not been viewing events from the proper perspective. I've been a Sunday afternoon sports spectator, looking at all the action from my couch and involved in what I'm watching, unaware that people can watch me in turn from the kitchen or hallway or even outside and laugh because I'm so engrossed by minor happenings in my narrow vision and cannot see the bigger picture. This is not about Taiwan. I've certainly not been sent to save it because it is in perfectly capable hands. This is about whether I can step outside my own exquisite narcissism and serve a greater cause. This is about my field of vision, about my judgment, about how someone obviously felt I wasn't able to judge for myself where my talents would best serve Gaia, so I was sent here to be safe. Oh my, that's it. I've been packed off on a milk run. Faced with just enough danger to make me feel like it was something real. No wonder Flittish didn't feel like there was any hurry to tell me about this caper. She knew she was essentially escorting me to the kiddie pool to splash around in shallow waters, and she knew that's what she would be doing in Japan, too. The Shinto deities would need us no more than the Taoist or Buddhist ones. The question becomes, why would Briat do this to us? To save Druidry. An obvious answer once I ask the question. In case everything goes wrong in Sweden and Loki's forces prevail, I'll still be around, as will Flittish and whoever else they've sequestered in undisclosed locations. Owen, perhaps? Where's he, I wonder? Keeping his grove safe, I hope. The two immortals have stopped fighting, I notice, and Wukong's clones have circled around us to provide a sphere of protection. Apparently I've spaced out a bit, and they're waiting for me to come around.
Wukong.
He merely raises a bushy eyebrow at me. Did Briett ask you to keep me occupied during Ragnarok? His eyes slide over to Erlan Shen, and they share a tiny smile. They'd either been waiting on this, or they had a bet going as to whether I'd figure it out.
I think perhaps our American friend is finally challenging her assumptions,
he says to Erlan Shen, which is not precisely an answer, but confirms my suspicion.
Damn it! Then you don't need me here? I can go help somewhere else and you can end this on your own?
Of course.
But you'll shut down King Taishan and the others soon. The Earth is being harmed every time the portal opens.
We will, Wukong assures me. But are you finished learning, then?
Oh, shit. I've missed something important, or he wouldn't prompt me like that. I look around and see nothing obvious, so it must be that I have made yet another assumption.
Wait. When Briett made this arrangement with you, did she say why?
I'm afraid I'm not allowed to recall.
Not allowed? Briett must have extracted a promise not to reveal any details of their conversation, but there was clearly something to reveal that Wukong thought I should know. I shudder at a sudden suspicion, a thrill of cold fear coursing down my spine.
Did someone put her up to it?
The Monkey King shrugs, helpless.
Wukong is bound by oath not to answer, but I am not.
Erlan Shen replies.
Briett made these arrangements with us at the urging of Xiahano Sullivan.
I gasp audibly, shocked and saddened to have my suspicion confirmed. I didn't want it to be true, but he knew when Ragnarok was going to begin. He had advance warning and time to set this up, and he probably thought he was doing the right thing. That's when heat flushes my cheeks.
Of all the bullshit patriarchal moves he could pull. Well, he and I are going to have a talk. Perhaps even a spirited fracas,
I add, after thinking that this is precisely the sort of thing that got Flittish in trouble with Pirun. You don't make plans for someone else and not consult them. Which is not to say I haven't enjoyed my time here. I feel like I have learned and grown, and I was led to it in a much different way than I'm used to. And as much as I was frustrated by the leading questions and the vague statements at first, I can appreciate with hindsight how effective they were. It's a way of thinking I should cultivate.
Sifu-san,
I say, bowing to the Monkey King. May I return at a later date to learn more?
What is it you wish to learn?
Whatever you wish to teach me. How to make perfect bubble tea. More about Buddhism. How to fight. But I also wish to learn Mandarin. I'm nearly ready to add another headspace. Sun Wukong smiles at me.
Very well. You know where my shop is. I will be there when you are ready.
Thank you. And I'm very grateful for the training you've already given me.
Do not let it go to waste.
I won't. I bow again, and also to Erlan Shen, before taking my leave. Fighting through the dam to get to the bound tree. True to the Monkey King's word, King Bian Chen lands a short distance away, armor shining and face snarling, eager to have a go at the druid who killed King Wu Guan. He draws his weapons and advances. But I put my hand on the bound tree and shift away, leaving him to Erlan Shen. There's a fight going on in Sweden, and once I get there, I don't know if I'll go after Loki or Atticus first.
Chapter 22. I'm so feckin' tired after the swim that I might need to try one of those superfoods modern humans are always on about. Thinking I might try kale, even if Greta's right and it's somehow worse than old man balls. Or maybe I'll be set right by some pancakes, drizzled with maple syrup and a hot mug of coffee. Sounds less risky to me, more of a sure thing. The elementals tell me I've applied the second law of Owen as much as Gaia requires. There are still all sorts of fires to put out, but others are seeing to it, and a primary shite festival in Sweden is still happening, but that's not a fight for me own fists. I hope Sheehan and Grunuel are all right, but all I can get from the elementals is an assurance that they're still alive. I am given leave to return to Flagstaff, and a rare gift. In return for saving Bavaria and Amazon and more, the elementals ask what I'd like to be called from now on, instead of Avenging Druid, and I tell them Oaken Druid would suit me fine.
Oaken Druid it is. Harmony.
Harmony? I sit, and ask Slow-Mo if she'd like to visit me home before returning to her jungle in Peru. I give her a mental picture of what the trees look like there, the ponderosa pines, and the alligator junipers, and the white-barked aspens.
Sure, Oaken, she says. Would I be the first sloth to ever dangle from those trees?
I think so.
Securing the first dangle is a great honor among sloths. Let's go.
I shift to a bear once more and give Slow-Mo a ride out of the lake area. Some people are starting to appear on the shores, and I'm afraid they're going to notice us soon. I'm pretty sure they would have some questions about why there's a Peruvian sloth in Poland. After we shift to the bound tree on Greta's property, where it's late evening of the night before, Slow-Mo drops off me back to barf quietly on the forest ground. She staggers a bit to the right afterward.
Whoa, Oaken, I feel woozy. It's super dry here, too.
I give her a bit of energy from the earth. How's that?
Better, thanks,
she says.
But I should probably eat some leaves soon.
Well, fetch you some. Stay here. I'll be gone for just a wee while. It's only a few minutes' work to shift back to Peru, gather some leaves from those trees she likes, and return.
Oh, wow! Those look delicious! Thanks.
Crawl up on me back and you can eat while we go down to meet me girlfriend and apprentices. They'll be delighted to meet ye, I promise. And they are. They've all switched out their spheres from Tasmania in their lockets with Colorado sandstone, so they're able to communicate with Slow-Mo, much like me, in images and feelings. Everyone is delighted. Slow-Mo establishes first dangle on an aspen near the house and eats leaves while the kids laugh and talk with her. A couple of parents stay behind while I go inside with Greta and the rest of the pack to fill them in on what's been going on with me, and they catch me up with what happened in Tasmania after I left.
We obviously decided to return home since we didn't know how long you'd be gone.
Greta speaks from the kitchen because she's trying to make my dream of pancakes come true. It was time for breakfast in Poland, but it's bedtime in Flagstaff, and I realize with a yawn that I don't properly know what day it is or when I last slept for more than a couple hours. Sam and Ty, the co-leaders of the Flagstaff pack, arrive after a few minutes and look mighty pleased to have me back, since it probably means we can resume tearing the hell out of each other in sparring matches. They don't often get to unload against anyone who can challenge them, and they like it. Truth is, I do too. Sometimes I win and sometimes they do. It's good to have some mates who'll beat the shite out of ye in the friendliest manner possible, and don't get sore when ye beat the shite out of them. And those lads are an example of how to be lovers. They've been together more than 100 years, and they still think the man they married is the best man on earth. But after we catch up, they start talking about wine for some reason, and that's a subject about which I know very little. In fact, I don't know jack shite. That's an expression Sheahan taught me, but I don't rightly understand it. I have so many questions. Sometimes people leave off the surname and say, "Ye don't know Jack," but everyone knows you're not talking about Jack Black or Jack Daniels or Jack B. Nimble. Nay, when someone says, "Ye don't know Jack," it's automatically understood that they're talking about jack shite. But it makes ye wonder why anyone would walk around this world with the surname of Shite. If ye have such an awful name, wouldn't that be a fine excuse to change it to Jones or something common and boring and unrelated to feces? And what's really confusing to me is whether we should know a lad named Jack Shite or not. Sometimes people say,
"Ye don't know Jack Shite,"
and ye can tell by their tone that you're practically the only person that doesn't. But sometimes people sneer at ye and say, "You know Jack Shite."
and a scorn in their voice lets you know that he should have never been introduced to him, even by accident. Well, I don't know Jack Shite yet, and I'm mighty conflicted about whether I want to meet him or not. He's a controversial figure. I'm wondering if Sam and Ty know Jack Shite, and I realize they must, because they know so much about wine, so I don't ask them out loud. The conversations fade until Greta shouts me name and I startle straight up. Eh? What?
You need to go to bed, she says. You've drifted off twice now.
I have? When was first time?
Just go. You've been mumbling about not knowing Jack Shite.
But Shlomo!
She'll be fine. The kids will let us know if she needs anything, and if she does, we'll wake you. She probably needs to sleep too, and there's nothing out here that will mess with her.
Oh, ye definitely don't want to mess with her, I says. Greta asks Tandy's dad, Sunque, to finish up the pancakes and store them while she pulls me from my seat and escorts me to the bedroom. Me limbs feel like lead weights, and me vision's all blurry. Me brain knows I'm somewhere safe, and it just wants to shut down and recover.
Don't want to mess with me, either,
Greta says. Which is all too true. Once I collapse on the bed, I feel her lips press against mine briefly.
Thanks for coming back safe to me, Teddy Bear.
Woken. I mumble, on the edge of slumber.
What?
Woken now.
All right. Woken, Teddy Bear.
Something about that isn't quite right, but it's not worth climbing back to consciousness to figure it out. I have a wee space to myself to enjoy some peace, and I'm gonna wallow in it as long as I'm allowed, because after that we have so much feckin' work to do, and puppies to raise. Can't forget Orla's puppies. Me Grove will be so pleased.
Chapter 23. For the record, and at risk of stating the obvious, looting corpses is nothing like the way it's presented in video games. You click, get a little sound effect and a tiny hit of serotonin, and coins are automatically put in your purse and items go into your giant bag of holding, possibly to be equipped, possibly to be sold later to an NPC for meager ducats. It's fast, bloodless, and carries little risk of disease or septicemia. No interaction with an actual corpse is necessary, which is true of every aspect of games. There's no actual anything. But looting has always been a casual pastime in games, one of the fun parts. And I guess I wish it wasn't, because it turns us into vultures. If you want to loot a corpse, make sure you know from the start that it's going to be literal dead weight, and that you might pull a muscle. There's going to be blood, and there's going to be shit. Not the mere stink of it, but actual shit. Might be some brains lying around too. It's gonna take far longer than a mouse click to get the job done, and when you finally get the armor that you need off the corpse, you will probably find it doesn't fit well. And the weapon won't be a legendary blade like Fragra either. So it was that I searched several fey corpses for adequate replacements. I settled for the third, finding a sleeveless shirt to wear under a cuirass and some basic breeches, over which I secured a hardened leather skirt to protect the legs, fastened by a belt. Boots that fit took another three tries. I did find a sword with a whiff of magic about it, and a look at the bindings in the magical spectrum revealed that it was an unbreakable blade. I picked up a shield, too. Considering myself to be at least partially protected, I sought out Briett. I couldn't wait to finish this, to bring an end to the danger I'd put everyone in by making two disastrous trips to Asgard years ago. The people fighting Surtr's fires around the world, or who may have perished in them, that was on me. Everyone who'd fallen here, or who fell elsewhere in some battle provoked by Loki's allies, that was on me too. Fand, and Munnanen, and the three Yeti, and so many more. There was really no way I could ethically walk away from this, despite my attempts to rationalize doing just that. To be fair, I should be facing Ragnarok all alone. I was the one who killed the Norns and set this snowball rolling, so I should be the one who stood in the path of the avalanche.
It took some time to make my way to the front without killing any of the Fae with my iron aura. The human had no such vulnerabilities, however, and it was they who protected Briat on either flank as she swung her sword at the necks of Draugr and let her armor take the occasional hit. On her immediate left, however, was a curious figure in green and silver livery, one of the Fae, who held no weapon nor tried to attack. He simply existed and had some incredible kinetic wards. Every time the Draugr tried to attack him, their force was returned upon them with degrees of magnitude. I came around to Briat's right to make sure I didn't disturb him. "Briat! It's Sheehan!" I had to repeat this several times to get through to her, but once she spared a glance my way, she pulled back and let the human close up the gap.
"Sheehan, what has happened? Why does Loki have your sword?"
"I had to leave it where we killed Hel."
"Ah, I wondered if he spoke true when his voice rolled across the field and said you'd killed his children. But who are we?"
"One of the Native American coyotes helped me. He's the forward-looking sort, didn't want this mess coming to his continent. He's had enough of being invaded."
"I see. Is he still here?"
"No, he's decided he's done enough. Did you also hear Loki's challenge to me?"
"Everyone heard it."
"I know where he is and can lead you to him. Do you want your shot at winning the Girl Scout cookies?" Briat shrugged.
"I want the victory and honor more than the cookies."
At a sudden thought, she frowned at me.
"But why help me? You bet on Athena."
"Yes, but Athena will get fried almost instantly. You won't.
And I bet you have wards that will deflect those arrows he's letting loose."
The goddess of poetry, fire, and the forge smiled.
"Yes, he has already attempted to slay me with one from afar."
"Excellent. Shall I usher you, then, to a fight worthy of your skill, which will burnish your reputation and live on in the songs of bards?"
"Absolutely, Sheehan. Usher away. Let us form a detail."
Her eyes slid away from me for a moment, and she smiled over my right shoulder, but when I looked behind me, all I saw was a tightly packed throng of Fae keeping their distance. When I looked back, she had turned to shout orders at the human and the Fae lad in livery whom she called Coriander. They formed a sphere of protection around us, with Coriander at the point, and rather than hold the line, we pushed forward into the throng of Draugr and began a slow jog, the human batting aside the undead instead of trying to decapitate them, and Coriander plowing through them like a cowcatcher on the front of a train. We were not trying to win by attrition now. We had a destination in mind. I directed them straight ahead until we got to the base of the volcano, which was essentially the edge of the former lake, and then we turned right. I did not see Garm anywhere, and even though he tried to eat me on two separate occasions, I hoped he was okay and recovering. I cast my eyes back to the front. Coyote and I had basically advanced straight forward from the Alfar position, and we were approaching it now. "Should be coming up soon," I told Briat. "Somewhere slightly uphill from us. Loki will use fire at some point and probably shapeshift, so beware."
"Remain in my shadow," Briat replied, "and you will be safe from the fire."
I wasn't sure any of us would be safe. After throwing a horde at us, Loki had to be confident of being able to face down Odin and Thor and the rest of them if he wanted to win this thing. He'd been planning for this a long time, and wouldn't have called me to fight him if he wasn't confident of the outcome. My calculation was twofold. I had it coming, and whatever happened to us, the rest of the assembled gods would see it and know where Loki was. Engaging with us would paint a big target on his back, or face, whatever. And both Briat and I had backups. She'd kept Agma behind in Tir na n'og somewhere to lead the Fae should she fall, and Flitish was in Japan. Granuaile and Owen would continue druidry if I fell, especially Owen, who had a fine grove going already. I imagine Granuaile would like to add a couple more headspaces before she took on any apprentices, and I hoped she was safe dealing with whatever threats emerged in Taiwan. The first sign we were close came when an arrow struck the kinetic ward surrounding Coriander and its bladed tip shattered to pieces. The second unmistakable sign that we'd found Loki was when he loomed out of the throng, growing to the size of a giant in seconds, and hosed us down with fire that he channeled from his sword. The bow and arrows were nowhere to be seen, nor was Fragora. Coriander had some rudimentary protection against fire, but as the arrows of Vayu had been no match for the kinetic ward, his protection was insufficient against the heat Loki was bringing. Likewise for the human, whose only fear was fire. While they all flinched and cried out under the onslaught, Briett shouted at Coriander to retreat behind her, and she charged straight forward, arms spread out, gathering that flame to her and redirecting it to the Draugr on either side of Loki. The Lord of Mischief had to stop soon afterward, because Briett leapt at him, her own sword ready to deliver a killing blow, and he had to deflect that. The metal of their swords screamed as they slid against each other, and Loki twisted impossibly to let her pass by, and his push at the end forced her to tumble off balance. But now he had enemies on either side of him, and he couldn't abide that. He waved at the nearby Draugr to either attack us or protect him, and the distinction mattered little. They rushed in from all sides, and that meant I'd have very little ability to attack Loki. He wanted to focus on Briett, the clearest threat. Once she was out of the picture, he'd be able to fry us without interference. His head turned away from us even as his left hand pulled out a knife that looked familiar, a cold blue ice knife with a red line along the top of the blade. It was one of the Yeti whirling blades, the one he'd stolen from Granuaile in India.
"Oh no, you fucking don't!"
A voice said behind me. But when I turned, all I saw was Yumin, who cannot speak, and beyond them, Draugr. But then, I wouldn't have seen anything if that voice belonged to who I thought.
"Granuaile?"
I said.
"Are you here?"
"We'll talk later," her disembodied voice replied. "I have a score to settle."
"I thought you were in Taiwan."
"We're gonna settle that too, believe me."
"What?"
I got no answer. I got a face full of Draugr instead. I fell into a defensive sphere with Coriander and the human and missed Froggerod desperately. Swords that don't cut through armor can't compare. That was a fact Loki was finding out in his battle with Briett. He kept shifting his shape as his blows came in, and Briett couldn't react in time to them, so he landed both with his accustomed sword and with the whirling blade. But both were turned back by Briett's armor. She disarmed his right hand soon afterward, managing to open up a wound along the inside of his forearm. In need of a new weapon, and unable to pick up his old one without exposing himself to attack, he did what any infinitely malleable shapeshifter would do. He reached into his own body and pulled Fragora out of there, slimed with Loki juices. He met Briett's next attack with it and surprised me by being a far better fighter than I thought he'd be. He counterstruck, but again slipped past Briett's guard with a trick, and that's when Briett learned whether the armor she'd forged specifically to withstand Fragora worked or not. It sort of did. Normally Fragora treats armor like it's denim. There's some small resistance, in other words, but not enough to matter if you're striking well. Briett had forged that armor at a time when she worried that Fragora could fall into the hands of her enemies and be used against her. She'd never had it tested until now. Loki's blow was a powerful one, and it sank into the top of Briett's left shoulder plate and the top of her chest, knocking her backward. But she took Fragora with her, lodged in the armor. Perhaps the blade bit into her, and perhaps it didn't. The armor wasn't perfect, but it did the job, because that would have been a disabling or even killing blow against any other armor. Both Loki and Briett appeared stunned by the outcome. Loki was once again disarmed, and Briett had a sword stuck in her kit. Before either could resume, however, Loki cried out as a sharp crack announced the shattering of his left ulna at the distal end, right at the wrist, in other words, which caused him to drop the whirling blade. He reared back, cradling his arm, his teeth bared in a hiss as he searched for the cause. Granuaile dismissed the binding on Scowaja that kept her invisible, whirling blade in her left hand.
"Hi!"
she shouted up at him.
"Remember how you stole this from me?"
She flashed the ice blade at him.
"Ambushed me? Broke most of my bones? Lured my father into a death trap? You! Yep, me. Just wanted you to know who got you. No!"
Fire bloomed on Loki's right fist, and I hoped Briett would stop him, control that fire before it could hit Granuaile, because she had no defense against it. But the fire snuffed out as Granuaile whipped the blade at Loki's thigh, mere feet from where she stood, and it plunged into the muscle above his knee. The vortex in the tip of the blade sucked the soul right out of him into that glowing reservoir. But his was no ordinary spirit. His was the soul of an old god, and it was too much for the whirling blade to contain. It quivered, and then shattered into chunks of ice and mist, and the malignant spirit of Loki dispersed with it. Loki's body, meanwhile, shrank and ejected a number of weapons from his torso as it fell, including the arrows of Vayu and the bow he'd been using to shoot them. As when Hela died, the Draugr lost interest in fighting folks who fought back, and began to drift away toward the human city. The Norse pantheon, which had bided its time until now, sprang into action. The cloud that had been hiding them from view grew and shifted perceptibly to enshroud the human helicopters, and only once they were screened did the Norse deities emerge, joining the armies in routing the Draugr. Valkyries swooped down to sever necks with great axes. Mjolnir plowed through them from above, crunching them into small craters, and returned to Thor's hand for another throw. Odin rode out with Hugin and Munin circling above him, Frigg and Freya flanking either side. I checked on the human and Coriander, all singed but alive. I left them to see whether Briett was all right. She'd gotten to her feet and was wrenching Fragra out of her armor. She won it free as I got there, and she offered it to me. There was no fresh blood on the blade.
"I think you dropped this,"
she deadpanned. I tossed my looted sword aside as I took it from her. "Yes, I did. I had a hound on my tail at the time." My head whipped around to the west. I wonder what happened to him. I didn't see him standing above the Sea of Draugr.
"He may yet live, and if he does, we will return him to Niflheim."
Grunts and punting noises drew our attention to Granuaile, who was kicking Loki's still form.
"You evil fuck! Victory's mine!"
She stopped after that and stepped over him to where the arrows of Vayu lay on the ground. She scooped them up in her left hand and then glared in our direction, daring us to challenge her right to them.
"I deserve to keep these. He tricked my father into going after them, and I suffered quite a bit to find them."
I nodded at her. "No argument here."
"Of course,"
Briett agreed. She gestured at the body.
"Well done. Whether you wanted a cookie for that or not, you're going to get thousands."
"How do things go in Taiwan?" I asked.
"I'm glad I went," she replied, "because Sun Wukong is an excellent teacher and Taipei is a wonderful city. I'm going to make Mandarin my next headspace. But I wasn't truly needed there. The masters of the heavens are more than a match for the lords of hell. And you knew that. You both made a decision for me as if I were a child, and I don't appreciate it. You might think the difference in our ages makes you wiser somehow, but I don't need to be thousands of years old to know you shouldn't treat someone like that."
Neither of us was able to respond, because a good chunk of the Norse had arrived. Thor and Freya landed first, each in their chariot, on either side of Loki's body. Odin and Frigg appeared soon after, escorted by Valkyries, and they set up a perimeter, making sure the retreating Draugr streamed around and didn't interrupt. Or interrupt us, anyway. I felt fairly certain they would be interrupting the citizens of Skogol soon.
"Who slew him?"
Odin demanded. Granuaile raised her hand with the arrows clutched in them.
"I did."
The Norse all blinked in surprise, clearly expecting Briett to have done it.
"The druid. We didn't know you were here."
"Late arrival."
"You win all the cookies, then."
"Yeah," Briett mentioned something like that.
"There is a more important matter to settle, Odin," Freya said, descending from her chariot, sword in hand. "And you know it?"
"I do, yes. Your pardon, Freya. Druid,"
he said, and pointed to me so that there would be no question to whom he was speaking.
"You have committed many crimes against the Aesir, for which you now need to answer."
"I've already answered," I said. "We made a deal in Oslo. I returned Gungnir. I helped destroy both Fenris and Jormungandr, and I was instrumental in slaying both Hel and Loki."
"You never made a deal with me, druid," Freya said. "You killed the Norns and unleashed all of this. You killed Sleipnir, and your actions brought about the deaths of Ratatosk, my brother Freyr, Heimdall, Thor, and many Valkyries."
"First," I said, pointing to the Thunder God, "looks to me like Thor's fine." The others she'd mentioned weren't fine, though, or at least they weren't in attendance. Four figures muscled through the throng of Draugr and passed between the Valkyries. It was the Olympians, Athena and Minerva and the two Apollos. Owls swooped down to land on the shoulders of the goddesses of wisdom. "And for the rest, I have made recompense. You even helped us fight Fenris."
"Yes, at Odin's request," I agreed to defer my vengeance until a later date to accomplish a strategic goal. But that deferment has now ended. You have not answered for what you did to me personally, and Ordin cannot bargain that away. And for that offense, I call you out right now.
Wait, what offense? Groniwale said. I closed my eyes and sighed. I knew Freya would never forgive me, and I could not blame her.
He recruited the Frost Giants to help him invade Asgard, Freya explained, and their promised payment was me.
What? Atticus? You never told me this.
No, I didn't.
People tend not to volunteer what shames them the most. This was, as I'd feared, my personal judgment day, and I had so much to answer for. A discordant symphony of poor choices that accelerated and crescendoed from the moment I decided to fight Angus Og. Boneheaded moves, rooted in codes of honor and loyalty more than logic. Astounding dismissals of the warnings of two deities, one of them omniscient, who stated in plain terms that this wouldn't end well for me. And I am just honest enough with myself to realize that I would probably make those same decisions again. For that is how deeply flawed I am. My long life has not made me especially wise or some paragon of moral rectitude. It has just given me greater scope to cock everything up. Coyote's observation that all presidents were narcissists came back to me, for it struck me that I might be one such. Not a politician, of course, but a person in power who made decisions in his own self-interest over the obvious interests of a great many other people. I stepped away from Briat on suddenly unsteady knees and faced the Norse goddess of war and beauty. Physically, my knees should be fine. I'm still enjoying the ligaments and cartilage of a man in his early 20s. But such is the power of emotion over our bodies. Freya, I apologize. I never should have done that.
I didn't come here for an apology.
The grin on her face contained no scrap or hope of mercy. That same grin bloomed on the faces of the other Norse in attendance, and I remembered they had flashed such smiles before the battle, too. This confrontation had been planned all along. They'd been looking forward to it. I know. I wanted to give you one anyway. It's sincere. Frey ignored this and bent her knees ever so slightly, raising her sword and her eyebrows.
So you will answer on your own? No pleas to Briat or summoning the Morrigan to your side?
I will answer. I glanced at Groniwale and added, on my own, to make sure she wouldn't intervene. The land we stood on was dead, drained by the portal to the lower realms of the Norse. I was out of energy. My bear charm drained. I could not boost my strength or speed or perform the simplest binding without Gaia's energy. I was a mere human, squaring off against a goddess who once held her own against the Morrigan and walked away. A trained fighter, sure, and with an excellent weapon, but still, a mere human.
Good,
she said, crouching down to spring. I set myself in a defensive stance and felt the adrenaline begin to pump into my system. It didn't help much. When Freya attacked, she blurred with speed, and the only reason I got Fragora up in time to block her blow was that she had some distance to cover, and I guessed right about where the attack would come from. It came from above, just to the left of my head, and though I placed my blade in the perfect position, her strength was such that it simply knocked my blade down on contact, while only slowing her strike somewhat. The edge hit my scavenged fey armor between my neck and shoulder, and it held, but I staggered back, and she followed, kicking me in the chest to make sure I went down. That knocked me clean off my feet, and I crashed into the flash-cooled volcanic earth, crunching my head onto something and seeing lights pop in my vision. I heard some chuckles, maybe someone retching, but saw no incoming attack. She was waiting for me to get up again, playing with me. And I felt the hot trickle of blood on my neck. I'd gashed my scalp and most likely earned a concussion. But when I got up, I didn't feel like waiting for another beatdown. I charged and delivered the best flurry of attacks I could manage,
but her speed and strength allowed her to deflect and parry and repel me. It was abundantly clear that I couldn't win, and that she could end it whenever she wished, but she wasn't smiling anymore. Her expression was one of intense concentration. She was looking for something, but what was she after? She beckoned me forward, but I planted myself instead. I wasn't going to give her what she wanted.
"Fine,"
she growled.
"I'll make you hurt first."
First? Before what? I wondered. But then she launched herself at me, and after my initial attempt to block, I was rocked by punishing blows to my body from both fists and feet. I took the pommel of her sword in my right temple, which stunned me until a tremendous impact chunked into the top of my right shoulder just outside the protection of the armor, and it dawned on me, far too late, what she'd been after. I toppled over a few pounds lighter, my blood spraying onto the ground, and I let loose a single cry of horror and disbelief. Freya had cut off my right arm. Chapter 24.
Turns out you can actually be sick with worry. I always thought it was just an expression, being worried sick. But I'm so stressed and fearful for Atticus as the duel begins that I throw up a little bit. Because without the Earth's power at his call, he's so slow compared to Freya. He doesn't have a chance, and he's well aware, and fighting anyway, and I'm sure that she's going to kill him, especially after that first blow. That's when I toss my cookies. But then she beats him down, hacks off his arm, kicks it away, and all I can think is that he's going to bleed to death because there's no way he can heal. I mean, apart from the fact that there is no power to draw upon, his healing triskele is now separated from his command. And so are his bound animal forms and his ability to shift planes. I lunge forward and open my mouth to shout, "That's enough!" But Freya backs away and turns to the Norse, making it unnecessary.
"It is done!"
she crows, apparently agreeing that she has meted out sufficient justice. She spreads her arms wide, sword dripping Atticus's blood, enjoying the approval of the assembled deities and Valkyries, and I rush to his side and kneel next to him. His eyes are unfocused, in shock already. I have a little bit of Gaia's energy remaining in the silver reservoir of Scowager, and I use it to close off those pumping arteries and prevent him from bleeding to death.
"Do the Olympians bear witness?"
Freya says, and it's such a strange question that I look up to see the Apollos nod, and then Athena and Minerva also. Minerva's cool, rich voice says,
"I will tell Diana and Bacchus it is done."
Athena chimes in,
"Artemis will be pleased."
Minerva adds,
"Of course, Diana wishes to have her trophy."
"By all means, it is yours."
I don't know what kind of trophy they're expecting, and I tense when Minerva comes forward, wondering if she's going to want his heart or something. But the goddess merely picks up Atticus's severed arm from the ground.
"Mercury was supposed to deliver this message," she says to Atticus. "But as he's not here, I would deliver it in his stead. Diana and Bacchus now consider their grievances with you satisfactorily concluded. You need not fear anything from them, so long as you do nothing else to awaken their wrath. I imagine it is the same with Artemis?"
She looks up at Athena, and her counterpart nods.
"It is."
Minerva returns her gaze to Atticus.
"Have you anything you wish me to say to them?"
Atticus shakes his head, his lips pressed tightly together as he takes deep breaths through his nose.
"Then, fare thee well, Druid," she says, and walks off with his arm, leaving Atticus no chance of reattaching it.
I crane my head around to see how Briett's taking this, and she's standing like an exhibit in the Hall of Armor at the Metropolitan Museum.
"Aren't you going to say anything?" I ask her.
"I said plenty to both the Norse and the Olympians earlier. They were not allowed under any circumstances to kill him."
"You allowed this?"
"I could hardly prevent it, Grunuel. They had serious grievances. Winning his life was the best victory I could expect."
"Gods! These gods! Making decisions about our lives without our consent, they just kept doing it. Am I to suffer some kind of judgment and sentence too?"
"No, you're free to go," Briett says. "In fact, you need to go."
What? Why? I turn back to where the Olympians had been standing and see that they've mounted the winged horses of some Valkyries, and they hold on as the choosers of the slain lift them above the hordes of Draugr. Freya answers me as she wipes Atticus's blood off her sword using some rags she had in her chariot.
We have some words to trade with him in private. He will come to no further harm.
I have words I'd like to trade with her, but I bite them back. Give me a moment, then. I get a scant nod, and then I turn to Atticus and try to pitch my words as low as possible, though it's probably a futile effort when one is surrounded by deities.
I'm so sorry about your arm. Relieved you're still alive, though.
He only nods at me, says nothing. I think he's doing some stoic thing or simply trying to deny the Norse any satisfaction at hearing him in pain, and he's scared that if he makes any sound right now, it'll come out as a scream. I know how that feels.
We need to talk more, I tell him, but this is not the time or place. I will go home and fetch whatever you need because you can't shift. Speaking of which, we need to get you out of here. Hold on.
I rise to my feet and find the Allfather calling out to him, Odin, may I strike a bargain? My winnings to you, all the Girl Scout cookies I'm owed, in return for taking Atticus wherever he wants to go on Bifrost and then bringing his hounds to him there directly afterward.
Done!
Odin says, much quicker than I'd anticipated. He didn't even have to think about it. He might have been intending to grant that favor anyway. Or he had an unhealthy obsession for Girl Scout cookies. Frick's scowl at this development seemed to imply as much. I squat down next to Atticus and lay a hand on his chest.
I will see you soon.
He nods twice, teeth clenched against pain. And then I rise again and sweep my staff around, pointing to all the deities and reminding them of what Freya said. No further harm. And then I run out of that circle of scheming immortals, race for the bound tree to the south, and let the tears I'd been holding back flow out and blur my vision. I counted that as a victory, too. I had shed nothing, neither blood nor tears, in front of those inhuman creatures.
Chapter 25.
It's perfectly natural to scream when one loses an arm at the edge of a blade, but beyond the first cry of surprise and pain, I shunted all the screaming I wanted to do into a different headspace, because giving voice to it would only give the Norse pleasure. Since there was very little else I could deny them, I would at least deny them that. But there was plenty of woe going on in that space as I realized that removing my arm had been Freya's goal all along. It wasn't just my sword arm. It was also my ability to heal, to shift planes, and to take animal forms. I'd still be able to perform free-form bindings and would retain the rest of my skills, but my effectiveness as a champion for Gaia was much reduced, and my life as I'd lived it for more than 2 millennia was over. I'd never fly as an owl or run as a hound again. I'd never be able to travel the globe as I used to. Granuel came over to administer what was probably a life-saving first aid, but then she requested that Odin bring my hounds to me wheresoever I chose to be deposited, as if I would never choose to go home to the cabin in Oregon. I might be thick about a great many things, but even I could tell what that meant. My day of judgment would soon grow worse, for it was pretty clear that in my love's eyes I had been found wanting. I understood finally what Jesus meant when he warned me against going to Asgard, when he said I'd suffer pain like I'd never felt before. Because everything I felt right then, the great gnawing absence that nibbled at the edges of my will to live, wouldn't heal up after a few weeks of convalescence. The physical pain would fade with time, but the emotions associated with the loss would stay sharp and prick me anew each day. Every time I wanted to slip into a river and play around as an otter, or take wing as a great horned owl, I'd have to remain awkwardly human and remember I'd only myself to blame. Oh, there was plenty of anguish bubbling away in that headspace. But I brought Old Norse to the fore as Freya approached. She picked up Froggaroff from the ground and took a knee next to me.
This sword will be my trophy. I personally think you should have been killed, because I am not persuaded that you have come close to balancing the scales. But Briett and some others lobbied in your favor.
She leaned closer.
I have to go clean up your mess now, because the Draugr are entering Skugahl.
I flick my eyes to the mass of bodies streaming past us, and realize it's the Einherjar and dwarfs in pursuit of the Draugr.
Wherever you choose to go after this, Druid, make sure it's far from here. You are not welcome in the lands of the Norse from this day forward, so long as you respect